That one audition.
This is That One Audition with Alicia Oxy.
Welcome to the honest, humorous, and inspirational conversations with your favorite on-screen storytellers and Hollywood influencers who reveal their most life-changing audition tales and survival skills they've collected along the way.
Today, I got to chat with Ben Barnes. This British actor, skilled musician, has charmed audiences as the heroic prince in the Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian, and surprised them as the enigmatic Logan in HBO's science fiction world, Westworld. His love for storytelling began early, on stage, performing with the National Youth Music Theater, and since then his career has told the story of an artist who possesses true grit, a love for craft, and a desire to explore whatever he hasn't done. He shares how blind persistence landed him his first agent and how a secret injury helped him create one of the most recognizable roles. For Ben, perspective and perseverance is key, and moving through the peaks and valleys of this industry requires trusting what you have to offer and choosing to be empowered regardless of circumstance. And that's exactly what Ben continues to do. His work includes an array of diverse film and television credits such as Easy Virtue, By the Gun, Seventh Son, Big Wedding, Sons of Liberty, The Punisher, Gold Digger, and a lead role on Netflix's soon-to-be series Shadow and Bone. These are the unforgettable stories that landed Ben Barnes right here. Audio discretion advised. This was over Zoom. Enjoy.
So, what are you doing during this quarantine time? Because this is a very special time for an artist. But you also do music, so I feel like you could still integrate some of your creative sense into something at this moment. But are you surviving or are you thriving right now?
Surviving or thriving, that's a good way to put it. Today is a good day. Today is a good day because I knew I had this class to look forward to being on and just to have that structure, because I feel as an actor, but in particular, especially if you've only been an actor for a number of years, your life is so micromanaged. Your structure is, you have call sheets which say you're being picked up at 5:47 in the morning, and then your lunch break is this long, and people follow you to the toilet, you know, to make sure that how long you're spending in there, because you know your time is other people's money, kind of thing. And I think so. I think it's normally such a relief when you finish a job to have that structure, just sort of disassemble and just sort of evaporate, and you really have that precious time, you know, that you can just feel like you're yourself again, to decompress and shake off your whatever character you've just been playing, and you know, remember who you are again a bit. But I think this is entirely different,
right?
Because it's enforced and it's everyone, and it's difficult. I don't know anyone who hasn't said how emotional they've been or how up and down they've been. I mean, people don't even ask how you are anymore. They ask how you're holding up.
Yeah,
you know, that's still normally something that people ask you. Have any experience that when family members have been ill or if you're grieving something or if you've been through a breakup, and now it's just the normal. And so I have, like everyone, had days where I've struggled, but honestly, today was an example of a good day because I had something to look forward to. And I've been desperately trying to claw in as many of those things as I can manufacture, really.
Right. Well, I think I had to do an interview earlier for myself about parenting and quarantine, while also I have a couple shows that are out right now. So I'm trying to do press for the shows myself. And I, in the middle of doing this interview, I was like, how interesting that we as artists who are so deeply empathetic, and when I ask, how are you doing? I want to know like your heart and soul from the beginning that I meet somebody. If it's a gas station attendant, I really want to know, how's your day? And tell me everything.
I don't want to hear fine ever. Yeah.
I don't either. And I will dig. And what I love about right now is on Instagram, which is everybody's highlight reel, but on every surface of our connection right now. It's at the core of its vulnerability. Like, and we're getting to see people's strength by them showing their vulnerability versus keeping it all together and giving this highlight reel of greatness. It's like it's given permission for the universe, for human beings to have a full scope of feelings again.
Yeah.
That is giving me so much reprieve and kind of acceptance in some odd way.
I entirely agree. But I think what comes with giving yourself permission to feel everything is that some things creep in there that you don't think you ought to be feeling during this time. And then you feel guilty about feeling that because it's so difficult for so many people right now. You know, people who are grieving and people who are, you know, forcing themselves to work every day for the benefit of the rest of us. And I think, you know, giving yourself a break of not feeling guilty no matter what comes into your head is so important.
And not feeling shame around if you're suffering right now, and not feeling shame around if you're exhilarated right now because you're getting to be with your family or getting to have space without any distraction, or not having shame if you're one of the ones that has to, like, I just am trying to remove shame from whatever anybody is feeling.
Absolutely. I started doing these, it's interesting what you do focus your time on, and you know, because I think as creative people, you do feel like you need to express something, and whether that's just something really silly. I've been doing these very silly videos with a friend of mine.
I love them.
News report thing.
I love them. I think it's hysterical. Yes, I was scrolling it last night. I got stuck.
But it's a nice, it was just a nice little challenge to write a tiny little thing every day and do one every day and sort of have it be funny and silly, but sort of have it have a point. And but the moment I started feeling, this is too much, people are going to get bored, this is silly.
No, it's not.
I spoke to a friend of mine who is a frontline doctor in England who was like, oh, I love these silly things. It's so nice to be able to look at it for 1 minute on my lunch break and just have it be kind of silly. And that's very heartening, even if you were beginning to feel a bit silly about it.
No, that's what I love. I'm doing this live at 5 where I'm talking to creatives on Instagram, a past guest of the podcast, being like, what are you doing? And I love that as creatives, you know, what are nurses and doctors doing? They're caring. They're doing the front line. What are we as artists doing? We're like, I'll sing for you today. Let me sing for you. We're trying to connect with our strengths and what we're here and our purpose to do. So I love that instead of, I think as artists, we can sit and wallow in the emotion because we feel it so much, or we can be directional and actionable with using our skills and talents. And you are singing, you're doing that. It's great.
And it's the things I like. Well, I love the sort of the freedom a little bit to do the things that you don't have to be so careful about. So yes. I'm quite a careful person quite a lot of the time.
I've noticed that. I've studied your resume and I'm like, is everything so calculated and quite careful? Because it's been
I don't know about calculated. I gave up trying to like have any control over what happens to you if you do choose this as an occupation a long time ago. But I can be quite careful. And I think that's what's nice about this time. It's like, well, what does it? It doesn't matter. Either people will respond to what you're doing and enjoy it for what it is, or they'll judge it. And if they judge it, it doesn't matter. So,
doesn't matter. There's no ratings. There's no box office. There's nobody. There's only comments that you can or cannot read if you want to.
100%. So that's what's made me feel a bit braver to do the
your little news show. I love it.
The funny things, or the music, and a lot of the music stuff as well.
Music stuff is so beautiful. I have so many questions. Like, why did the boy band collapse? Did acting take you out of being a boy band? You know, like, you coming up, did you always sing as a kid? Because I saw you did the National Youth Music Theater from 97 to 2003. That's a long time.
That was actually probably the thing which it sort of inspired any concept or notion that this might be something that you could do for a living. It was a company in the UK that did semi-professional productions, but all of them starred people from the ages of 11 to 19.
Oh, how wonderful.
And they did auditions every year all around the country. And some of the people that I met in that are still my absolute best friends to this day. And they did mainly new musicals. I sort of grew up doing singing. And then it's sort of...
How does it transition? Like, how do you go from boy band into acting? Or did they kind of work? Was it a parallel?
Well, the musicals, the sort of youth musicals stuff was about 14, 15 to about 19. And sort of every summer I would re-audition for the company. And then I would do these musicals in the Edinburgh Festival, or even in the West End. I did Bugsy Malone in the West End when I was 15. That was one of the highlights of my life. I was actually playing the drums in that production, and I would sort of leave school early to do the matinees with my drumsticks slung over my shoulder to go and be a jazz drummer in London. I thought it will never be better than this, and in some ways it hasn't been. I felt like I'd sort of found a group of people that I could be understood by.
Yes. And celebrated.
It was joyful. It was joyful. And then the boy band thing was a bit, it was around after that finished. And that was, it was very short lived. It was, I think I was in it for less than 2 weeks.
Oh.
And it's become this thing because when you're in a couple of films and then you go on Jay Leno or Jimmy Fallon, they play a little clip of it, and suddenly it was your entire childhood was spent trying to be in the Backstreet Boys, which is not a little bit unfair. We did one performance on television after about 10 days. I don't know who let us do that. And then the next morning I rang up the manager and said, I'm so sorry. It's too embarrassing.
Yeah,
it's not my kind of music. And I knew it wasn't. And sometimes I think you, especially when you're young, especially as an actor, you take any job, right? You get a job as an actor, you take the job. And it was sort of a bit the same for me with the music. I got off this opportunity to fill in for somebody, and I just love music so much. And so just any opportunity, I think, but I was a bit sort of blinded by the opportunity and forgot that actually it has to be, especially with music, has to be something authentic and something that you love. And I knew I didn't. And so the next day when I actually watched it and had the bird's eye view, I had to ring up and say, I'm so sorry, but this is just not my vibe.
That's incredible that you had this self-awareness though, to remove yourself from something that could have crumbled you and your spirit, and being trapped in the prison of putting out. So like, you know, for lack of a better example, Britney Spears, incredibly talented, but she's made to be something. And then we watched her break because that wasn't her, you know, like she's not getting to put forth her skill and talent in the way in which she wants to. Once you become a product of the music industry, or you're, you know, they need to sell. It's about
that. So difficult when you start acting, you don't have any say over, you know, the material or how the character come across, and certainly not in the edit. I know we've all been crucified in edits before and thinking, why are they doing it like that? And I think as you go through the as you sort of move through your career, the opportunity to have any voice in that creative process is such a thrilling thing, especially for me.
Yeah.
You know, I did an English literature degree, and I feel like I'm not necessarily the most creative person from scratch. I find a blank piece of paper incredibly intimidating. But if there's words on it already, I feel like, you know, I have the strength to analyze and refit and doctor things. And I love doing that as well.
You're so skilled at it.
I've always sort of tried to do it a bit, even since the very beginning. My very, very first film was a film called Stardust.
Yes. I want to know how, when you graduate from Kingston 2004, and then 3 years later, your first credit is a major studio film. How does this happen?
Blind persistence, actually. I wrote so many letters, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was sending out honestly, what I would send out would be a resume of, in England we call it a CV, of the productions that I did with the National Youth Music Theatre and at university, with a CD of me singing some songs and some still photographs of those university productions, which now seems like a mad thing to do. And of course, I got so many letters which were two sentences long saying, I'm sorry, we're not taking on new clients at this time or whatever. And I just had no idea, because people that I knew that were coming out of drama school would have those showcases where people would come and see them. But I didn't have that, and I didn't know what to do. Eventually, an agent took a chance and came to see me in a play that I was doing in a very small venue, which I think had about 12 seats in it. and I think four of them were sitting in about four of them. But one of them was this agent who's still my British agent to this day. And afterwards in the pub, we had a pint, and he said, all right, let's give it a try. And it did feel a bit like different times.
But that's kind of, I like hearing that, because it is about the persistence of who knows how many letters you sent out. It's about putting the energy out there of trying, and that didn't work, and that didn't work. It's just what acting is. That doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work. Pivot, change. And then when the opportunity presents itself, you're ready. You're ready for an agent. Yeah. You're ready to have a conversation with somebody that's like, oh, you're going to take a chance on me? Yay. Okay. Now what do we do?
And it's always some kismet, some little thing that you didn't expect. Because I thought the idea of sending a CD of myself singing was the stupidest thing. I regretted it so much, so often. But I met a man called Nick Reed, who was a writer's agent in America, a British guy. I emailed him, and he said, all right, I'll give you 5 minutes. I'm going to be in London. I'll give you 5 minutes in the hotel lobby. This is 20 years ago or something. And I sort of sat down, and he goes, well, I've got very small children. They like your singing. And they were literally 3 and 5 or something. And that was the thing that sort of made him want to meet me. And actually, eventually, a couple of years later, after Stardust, but I wanted to come out to America to try sort of see if I wasn't working in the UK after the first couple of jobs. And I really wanted to kind of change something. So I'm just a big proponent of if you're not happy and things aren't working for you, you have to change something, no matter how small. And I thought, well, America, that's a stupid idea. I could try that. And he said, but I couldn't really sort of afford to do it. But eventually we came to an agreement that he said, if you come and you babysit my kids, you can stay in my guest house. And I did that, and we've been friends to this day. And he got one of the talent agents at the company he was with, ICM, to take me on a trial basis. And they said, we'll take you on for 1 month, and if you get a job, you can stay, and if you don't, you're dropped.
Is this when you get Stardust?
No, I got a little pilot for the CW, which never amounted to anything. I think was probably very bad. But I did get that job.
So then they kept you on.
Actually, there was another job as well. I haven't thought about this in years, but there was the first audition I remember. Oh, I remember this so vividly. The first audition that I went to was for a sort of surfer shark film. And I turned up, and every man there had long blonde hair, rippling muscles, little singlet tops, shorts. And I turned up in jeans and a black button-down shirt, and I looking so young and out of place. And I remember feeling so vulnerable. And I think I called up the agent and said, I can't go in here, that I'm not right for this. And they said, well, just see it as a opportunity. Just see it as a challenge. See it as a thing. It doesn't matter. There's going to be so many you go for and you don't get. And I went in the room, and honestly, my heart was going so fast because I just felt so out of place. And the scene, of course, was a scene where you were being physically eaten by a shark in the scene. And I could hear everyone through this curtain shouting their way through this scene, thinking, well, I don't know very much, but I know that's not the way to do it. But I was so overwhelmed in that moment, I just started crying in the scene. It was nothing to do with my acting skills at the time. I didn't know how to manufacture a tear. I didn't know how to do anything. But I was just so overwhelmed. And then at the end of the audition, they just looked at me and went, can you do that again? And then they offered me this role, which was a staggering thing. And still to this day, I'm sort of loath to admit that it was not cheating, but it wasn't really. I was just having one of those days.
Well, but I also love that because I think in acting too, it's like one of those things, if you're having a day, no matter what emotion that you have, if you resist it, it's going to persist. If you lean into it, it might just work. There's a beautiful story that Bonnie Hunt told about the first job she ever got in LA. She, on the way to the audition, her car broke down. She opened her door. Somebody drove by, drove her car door off her car. She was driving there. The headshot flew out the window, whatever. This was like 20, 30 years ago, maybe longer. She got there and they gave her new sides and she had to cry. And she hysterically cried through the whole thing because her life was like, she's like, I don't have money for the car. So I just think sometimes just using however you're feeling, yes, it might not be the skilled thing at the moment, but it was something different that they had not seen. They'd seen people screaming all day. So then all of a sudden they're like, oh, genius.
And just sort of learning that, a lesson to learn, which I took me many more years to accept. I did not learn it that day, and I should have. That there is no... Because you get told so much that you're not this enough and not that enough and not, you know, not tough enough or charming enough or whatever enough. And I think there is a way for you to play any part.
Yes. Yes.
That has some essential quality that you have that some other people won't. There is a way to do it, whether that's what they are looking for.
Or not.
Who ever knows? You're not in control of that, but there is a way. Because I never, in my honestly, when I was in that National Youth Music Theatre and thinking about, I was thinking maybe, potentially, maybe one day I could be the third, you know, soldier from the left in Les Mis or something, and I could be the one of the chorus guys, and you know, never in my wildest dreams did I think I would be able to be in a film or on a TV show. And even less than that, did I think I'd ever be able to play like a tough guy or a bad guy or like anything like that.
And look at your resume now.
The last 6 years of my career is almost exclusively that stuff. And it's just very funny how, and the thing that tweaked for me in that time was just things transpire in your own life and change and you just see everything a bit more openly and a bit more clearly, and you just think, yeah, I can be, everyone is everything. It's just how you dial it up and how you dial it down, like one of those tablets in Westworld where you dial up the strength and dial down the vulnerability and dial up the empathy and it's just doing that. And I can't believe it took me so long to figure it out. Well, not figure it out, but accept it.
Yeah, I think it's accepting and revealing. We try to hide so many elements of ourselves. Like, oh, this part isn't Ben. None of this, I don't see myself in this at all. But really it is about revealing and finding those parts, because we are all those different components of human. You can be bad, you can be good, you can be whatever it calls for. And it's your interpretation of it. It's coming through your vessel, which makes it so unique and authentic. So
the irony is I've done so many big films where the essential theme of the film is you cannot have the darkness without the light. There is no one without the other. There is no, and I was spelling it out and not hearing it.
repetition, right? I do this podcast and I do what I call Wednesday Wisdoms. And sometimes it's because I need to hear that same thing over and over and over again. And I need to talk about it and I need to hear it. And then all of a sudden one day it's like, oh, now I cellularly understand what I've been trying to understand. I don't know if it's just life experience or getting out of our own way or getting back in touch with the oneness of everything and all the layering of self-doubt that we've put on or limitations that we put on ourselves to not see.
Yeah. It's always perspective for me. It's such a fragile thing to be able to maintain perspective on anything. And obviously, especially during like a time like this, when we're all having so much time to think about who we are and what we want and all of that stuff. And it's such a fragile thing to be able to step back and really see, you know, yourself in the context of anything, in the context of your industry, in the context of humanity, in the context of your family, in the context of any one relationship, anything. And it's so hard to hold on. It's sort of easy to get flashes of it and hard to hold on to it.
Yeah, I think that's what life is, right? Is kind of circularly, how would you say it? The cycle of coming back to it. It's like we touch it for a second and then it goes away and then we come back to it, kind of coming up the mountain. Well, then I'm so curious, with Stardust and the Chronicles of Narnia, was that when you were still in the UK or is that once you came to the States and you were with ICM?
Stardust was before that.
Okay.
Stardust was before that. And
Stardust, was that an opportunity that came once this manager decided to rep you after this play?
That was my agent sending me just in the room to an audition to play the lead character actually in Stardust. And then I got told I didn't get that, and the reason that they gave was really honest. And Matthew Vaughan, who was the director of that film, I've met him many times since, and he sort of said, I really thought that you could do that, but it was just a question of you'd never had any job at all, and that was a big sort of risk. And he's always said that he considered me for it, but then about 6 weeks later or something, I got offered the smaller role, which is the first sort of 10 minutes of the film, which was a perfect way for me to start, to be honest.
Yeah, because it's a huge studio film. You're walking in working with people that have been working for 30, 40 years. And when I sat down to research you, I was like, wait, hold on. How do you get to just walk right into, you know, you're learning from greats and having this responsibility?
Yeah, I didn't meet any of the greats on that film, I have to say. Not a single one of them did I meet. But also I was playing this character who was very wide-eyed and innocent and didn't really... I remember I only did about 4 days on it. My main day was walking through this magical marketplace, which had a lot of CGI effects that were put in afterwards, but it did have a lot of animals and incredible sets, and I'd never seen anything like that before. And I remember being sort of ushered onto the set by one of the ADs and walking through and just jaw agape, eyes wide, and Matthew Vaughan came running up and said, no, get him out, that's exactly the face I want you to do in a minute.
Exactly.
And honestly, they took me off the set and then only let me back on when they were rolling on it.
Once again, how wonderful that the two short stories that you've just shared right now are you getting to be authentically Ben and experiencing it in the medium of storytelling. So using elements of yourself at the beginning as you're learning your craft and as you're learning what all this looks like, that you're getting to highlight whatever feeling you're having at that moment. And that's being rewarded versus you trying to put on something or trying to act at something.
Yeah.
So then the Chronicles of Narnia, is that here in the States when you're with ICM?
No, so I was actually doing a play in London for the National Theatre, which was always my absolute dream. You know, my mum and dad used to take me when I was younger, and we still go any opportunity that we get. I just thought it was the most magical building, the most magical company. And I was doing a play called The History Boys in London at the time, and one of the casting directors for the Narnia film saw the play, and I auditioned in London.
And is it this at the same time that you auditioned for Twilight? Because I also saw in the research how far you and how close you got in Twilight, which I thought was interesting, that two films coming out at the same time.
I think that must have been afterwards, because I remember the conversations about, I don't really want the Narnia guy as the Twilight guy. And also I was older. I remember a lot of the conversation was I too old to play opposite Kristen Stewart, who they did already eventually have. But also I think it just boiled down to honestly. And I think this is one of the things about auditioning for sure, that you just have to be honest with yourself when you think it's one thing or another, which is that I think Rob and Kristen obviously had crazy chemistry. And I remember the sort of the final audition for that was at Catherine Hardwick's house. Uh-huh. And it was, a sort of a romantic scene with Kristen Stewart. I think it was filmed in a bedroom even. And, you know, obviously when you watch the film, I thought, wow, he must have been so confident in this situation in a way that I wasn't.
That you didn't feel comfortable with. It would also be, it's interesting to me that your second credit out the gate is such a monster hit. So now you're kind of globally known because of this film. You're getting awarded all the like breakthrough male performances. That if you had Twilight at the same time, would you have been categorized as that guy and kind of gone away? Do you know what I'm saying? When some people peak at the beginning of their careers and have such monster hits, it's hard for us as the audience to then see you in a different way. Like Rob has had to like go into indie world to kind of reinvent himself so people can see him as something other than Edward.
But boy, is he wonderful in some of these recent things.
Oh, he's so dynamic and special and magnificent. He's an incredible talent. I'm just talking about how the audience, like if you got caught in that area, that the industry is like, oh, he's so great at that. And then they kind of throw you everything that's the same. So you as an actor can express.
What's always been interesting to me is how after the bigger opportunities that I've got, once those have come out, you think it's all going to explode, and for me the opposite has been true.
Really?
Especially with Narnia, I remember not getting a job for a long while after that. Maybe it hadn't quite come out yet, but I remember a very fallow period and thinking, how is this? I don't understand how this works. And so often is that something that you ask yourself as an actor, to say, I don't understand how this has happened.
Right. And you're like, and now I feel like I'm starting all over. It's like coming back to that cycle point of like, oh, I'm in flow and everything's aligning and this is working great. And then become distant from that point.
Or you get offered a lot of things that are very similar. And I think, you know, somebody like me is very drawn to whatever I haven't just done. A huge part of the thrill of this is to try and have different experiences and try and see life through different people's psyches and really sort of sit into somebody that doesn't think like me and have that hypothetical, you know, that psychology of it is a huge part of the reason that I love doing this job. And so I'm often looking for something that isn't exactly what I've just done. And I think a lot of my friends will joke that, you know, I was boy with sword for quite a long time.
Bored with sword? Is that what you
boy,
said?
Boy with sword.
Boy with sword.
Ernest boy with sword.
Yes. And then having to break out of that mold. What project do you think allowed the industry to look at you as a fully expressed actor versus boy with sword?
I mean, I feel like I did a few things that I had some, it took me a very long time to feel proud of anything I'd ever done. Not in terms of the achievement, of getting a job. I was always proud of that. And I always thought that was an immense thing. And I still, to this day, when I get a job, think it's the most wonderful moment. But to actually sort of watch yourself back and feel proud is a really difficult thing. And because it's not usually something that I start out trying to achieve. Well, I want to do this project because I want to feel proud of myself.
Right.
It doesn't make, but actually in the end, it is more important than you give it credit for. And I think I did do some things that I was quite proud of. I did a little film called Killing Bono, which is a comedy. And so to do something that was so different, and it was written by Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet, who wrote The Commitments, which I was such a massive fan of. And just to sort of play as an Irish fool was something I was really excited about, but not very many people saw it. And then I had some jobs which I did, which I had massive expectations. I placed massive expectations on, and that's obviously, as you go through your career, something you learn not to do. But I did a film version of Dorian Gray, which I had been doing a film called Easy Virtue with Kristin Scott Thomas, and Colin Firth, and Stephen Elliott directed it, who directed Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And I thought that was a film which really was very, very sweet and funny and worked. And on the set of that, the producer gave me the book of Dorian Gray and said, why don't you have a little flip through this with thinking about doing it, which I did. And then I auditioned for the director, and he called me up about 30 seconds after I left the audition and said, will you be in it? Which is always the dream, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's like if you could press a button when you leave the audition room, and it's like, yes, you got it, or no, you didn't. So you don't have to think about it.
Yes, please. And while we were making it, we really thought it was going to be something really special, and it, for some reason, didn't quite work. The tone of it didn't quite work. It just didn't. I wasn't proud of what I did in it. And a lot of people now, you know, it's on sometimes at Christmas in England, and people say, oh, I love this. And I think, why? It didn't quite work for me.
It didn't translate. But in the shooting of it, was the experience of it, were you proud in the moment and you just didn't like the final outcome of it? The pieces just didn't fit together.
I was going through I think if I'm being really honest, I was going through a confident phase. And I think we all ebb and flow with that. And while I was making that, because I'd just come off the other film with Colin Firth and then went straight to this one, and they'd given me the book, and I felt like things were really working in a way that you know, sometimes they don't. And I was feeling very confident making it, thinking this is a classic novel and they're trusting me with it. And no, you know, everyone's saying good, nice things while we're doing it. And it felt like we were making a sort of a rock and roll version of a classic story. And then it just didn't turn out that way. And I accept a huge amount of the responsibility for that, because I don't love what I'm doing in that film. Particularly, I don't really believe myself necessarily. And I think that in the end, that the projects that I am really proud of are the ones where I believe myself.
So then what do you recover when you witness, because we all have it, when you witness work that you're like, oh, I could have done better. Are you looking at it as a learning experience? How do you recover to go into the next project?
When the reviews for Dorian Gray came out, I was filming The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the third Narnia film, in Australia. And I had a commitment to be at the Toronto Film Festival for Dorian Gray. And I wasn't given, or they were trying to manage it so that I wouldn't have to take any days off of filming. So I flew to Canada from Australia and back without stopping. I flew from Australia to Los Angeles to Toronto, went to the screening, did some interviews, went back, and then went straight back to work. But the reviews came out, I think, as I was on the way back. And they were honestly devastating. And sometimes I have a couple of them which I actually use now for younger actors when they feel they're being criticized. I think, you're not being criticized. This is criticism. You know, I genuinely use that because now I think it's funny. At the time, I very nearly didn't ever do any more acting again.
Yeah. I can imagine because it's a vulnerable part of you. And then you're having to go back to work. What did you do the next day on set when you have to go back to work? Were you able to put it out of your head, or did it make you act harder, which is like the worst description of it?
The worst thing you could possibly do. I mean, I think I just focused on getting back into the rhythm of what I was doing and thinking, well, this is another opportunity, and you take this, and you know, you're so fortunate to have another thing happening.
Yes.
And just be grateful for that. And then I think a few days later, I read the script for Killing Bono, and I was like, this is so different. And I did that audition. I had that audition to focus on, which I did in a sort of Skype, but this is quite a few years ago. So there was a huge lag delay, and I was in a huge conference room with no one else in the room trying to do comedy. But somehow it worked out. And I think just having something else to focus on to put it out of my mind. But honestly, that day was one of the worst days I can remember in the business. I remember, being in LA at the lounge, and there's this sort of section where you can put your suitcase to in between flights. And I remember getting into one of those little cubbyholes where you're supposed to put your suitcase and just sort of sitting and just falling down the sinkhole just to hide. I was like, and of course nobody would have known what the hell was going on, but I didn't want to be seen, like, let alone, you know, it was.
Isn't it amazing the highs and lows that can carry you through? And what I love about talking to you is that here we are 10 years later, and after the worst reviews given, you've gone on to do some of the best work that makes people jump out of their seats. You know, met with incredible writing. When I saw you on Westworld, I rewound and I was like, who the hell is this guy? And where did he come from? It's outstanding. Well, it's outstanding writing coupled with outstanding talent. And you, in the package that you are, being the bad boy, it's what you don't expect, which is even more compelling. Like going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, not thinking that you would play these types of roles, that's what captivates an audience the most, I think, is seeing something that we haven't seen before, because we all have something in us. And wow, I need to know how Westworld came to you, or when was the next project? Are you proud of Westworld, I should say?
I am. I'd done some other projects just in the lead up that were much smaller that I was also proud of. I did a film called Jackie and Ryan with Catherine Heigl. I really felt like it was one of the first things, the films I did that really like worked just as a film. It was a small film that didn't have massive expectation, massive ambition, but it just sort of worked. And I was proud of that because I just felt like it wasn't me.
Well, and it got to play on all your strengths too. You got to play music and you got to see, it's so much not you. It is a beautiful film.
You've seen it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film, because I was wondering if that, even though it was a smaller film, if that was something that allowed somebody within the industry to see you in a different way. Like when I was asking that question before, is like there was a role that kind of changed people's minds about you not being the boy in the sword anymore.
I think it was probably Westworld that people kind of thought, oh, he can do other things.
Mm-hmm.
But I had done other things that might have done that had anybody seen them.
Right.
Like Jackie and Ryan. And I did a film called By the Gun, which was a sort of Boston gangster thing, which I learned much later when I got the role in The Punisher as this sort of like psychopathic, violent, bad man. They said that they found that film and watching that was what gave them the confidence to cast me in that. So I think there are retroactively, yes, but I think it wasn't until Westworld that anybody else thought that I could sort of be anything else.
So then how does this
work? Amazing. And you're exactly right. It's the writing and the characters and something which just worked, and you're contributing to it.
Yes. And working for HBO is the dream. They put out I've had the opportunity to work with them. It is, I think, a top of a mountain experience for an actor. Their production value is insane. Their scripts are so original, their ideas, their messages, their content. Westworld, the title sequence The title sequence alone had me. I was like, I'm in. I'm so, this is so.
But that's another role. I didn't get that. I didn't get that role initially.
Okay. Since it's called That One Audition and everybody knows Westworld, I would love to hear the journey to you landing this.
Do you know, I haven't actually told the entire story of this ever before, but why not? So I auditioned for it. And I got a call a few days later saying they really enjoyed what you did with it, but you're too young. They want someone who's older than Jimmy Simpson's character. And they cast someone else. I don't know who or how or what, but I know that it was cast. And I had some family stuff in the UK. So I actually went back to the UK for a few months and took a bit of time, purposeful time off, and didn't do any other auditions. It was just that one I'd done. And then a few months later, I got a call to say that that role became available again, and you've got it. You've been offered it. Simple as that. Like out of absolutely nowhere.
So
they've just gone back to the...
They've just gone back to the drawing board.
And it turned out later, one of the showrunners, Lisa Joy, said, I just, as soon as we needed someone, I was like, well, it's got to be that guy, and we'll just make the character younger than that character, and that's what we'll do.
But you know what I think is so interesting?
Because they're decisive.
Because they decided. But you know what's so interesting to me is the collaboration of storytelling and how it comes together. Us as audience members not knowing that. You guys being of the same age made it more dynamic and interesting for me. If somebody would have been older, I just don't think it would have.
I think it was just a couple of years older rather than a couple of years younger. That was the sort of what they, you know, obviously, like I said, they have something, like before, people always have something in their mind of what they want. And if they find it, then that's great. But the sort of crazy thing about the process was that, so that was in the evening, and the following morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, the car arrived and I was going to have to fly back to the States and shoot two days later. And I came running down the stairs to get in the car, and I realized I'd forgotten my toothbrush. So I ran back up to grab my toothbrush. And as I ran back down the stairs, I tripped and fell and passed out at the bottom of the stairs. The car was outside. And I passed out from pain because I had broken my foot.
Oh my God.
And I woke up literally to my brother slapping my face. I was staying at my family home and slapping my face, and I sort of came around. And my first thought was, what am I going to do? I've got to go. And
what did you do?
Well, what I did was I thought, let's first little baby steps. I got in the car with some ice on my foot, thinking maybe it's just a little sprain, it'll be fine. And then I got to the airport and asked if I could have a bucket of ice on the plane. And I think they had, I seem to remember there was some kind of medical person for the airline that said, well, we have to see if you're fit to fly or whatever. And luckily they said, okay. And I had my foot in a bucket of ice the entire 11-hour flight. They kept refreshing it. The staff on the plane, who were amazing and so gracious and generous with me. And then I got there and I remember I had to have a medical. The first thing was have a medical, you know, you have to have a medical exam for every job you do. And luckily I was able to have it at my house. But I remember getting my roommate at the time to answer the door. And I must have seemed like the worst human being on the planet, because I was sitting down on the sofa and I said, please come in, sit down. And they don't make you do any physical test. They just ask you how you are and do your blood pressure and everything. And then she was like, okay, well, that's it. You're just gonna be. And she sort of stood up and put her hand out, and I just kept sitting down and shook her hand and said, thank you so much. And she must have thought I was the worst human being in the world. And I felt so dreadful, but I didn't want to, like, I just couldn't let on that I had this. But I was in so much pain on my foot. And then the next day I was shooting. And if you watch the scene, my first scene where I'm on the train and then I'm walking across through Worst World with Jimmy Simpson, I'm sort of doing the most cowboy-y.
Yeah.
Cowboy-y.
I thought it was a choice.
Yeah. Luckily, again, we're finding out on this podcast that it was another thing that was just, and then amazingly, I was able to sort of muscle my way through those first couple of weeks, and it obviously there's nothing you do for a book for anyway, but I just had to keep the walk, and no one was any the wiser.
This is incredible, Ben. Your journey through so many things has all come back to, like, the alignment of where you are with self and not letting whatever situation is happening at that moment get in the way. Like, it just is, it's a beautiful career to watch. And talking to you at the beginning about you being careful about certain things, but yet then so exposed and allowing yourself just to be in these moments has allowed people, it's magnetizing. Like, people can relate to you, and that's why you book like crazy. Has there been a moment where you're like, I can't do this. It's not going well. And how do you handle that? Because to me, watching and seeing all this, it just seems like you start it and it's a great trajectory and you're working. And we talked about some low moments, but has there ever been a moment that has made you really question, like, this isn't right for me?
Oh, so many, so many. I mean, the most intense one was when Dorian Gray came out that I told you a bit about. I honestly called up my agent and said, I don't think I can do this anymore. I think I'm too... not fragile, but too sensitive for this kind of criticism, which maybe everyone gets and they brush it off, but I don't know how to cope with it. That was a low point. And honestly, you know, there's been fallow periods where I just haven't been able to get a job for 6 months or something. I don't know anyone that's ever done this that hasn't had those periods.
Right.
Question. You don't trust in your skill set. You don't trust in your uniqueness. I think a lot of the criticism I got at the beginning, if I did get criticism at the beginning of my career, was about being boring or bland. And I think I took that really to heart. And so it was something that, you know, has really fired me up to, like, you know, be the more interesting, I think, on to be bolder with my choices, you know, on screen, and with my character choices. And
well, I'm so glad that you received that criticism, because I hate to use the word performance, but the work that you're generating now, I feel like that criticism allowed you to express more authenticity or uniqueness, because each one of your roles since this criticism has allowed your heart to really be exposed and vulnerable. And these roles are dynamic on you. They're beautiful. It's beautiful, captivating work. And you're going to continue.
I wish the 25 year old me could have heard that from someone or told me that it would be like that. I'm just realizing in this moment, can I tell you something completely unrelated?
Yes.
Which is that when I was 15 or 14, I did that. We had these exams that you did at school. And I went to this quite academically challenging school for boys, and didn't get on that well there. But when you had exams, they posted the scores in descending order. And I remember I did a mock exam for chemistry, and I remember coming absolute bottom, 200th out of 200, the worst score out of everybody. I was very bad at science. And I remember then spending the next, so that was in the mock exams, and the real ones were 6 months later. And I remember studying nothing but chemistry for those 6 months. Even though I hated it, I was so stubborn. I remember, so, and I think it must be a little bit of whatever that whatever that grit is that I don't often acknowledge in myself, I think, but whatever that is,
it's the most beautiful,
the same thing that,
yeah, I think that's the most beautiful experience as an artist and as a human being, to take something and then challenge yourself to rise above it. Because if you would have stopped at Dorian Gray, look at all the beautiful characters that we would have missed out on your interpretation of. So you taking that grit and changing it. I have one more question since you talked, I mean, you're so skilled. When you get an audition, when you get a character, talking about that grit, other than reading the script, is there a couple of things that you do to jump into the character from a bold place?
Yes. I think that I think about first, the first thing I usually think about, and I think this has been particularly useful in the last three or four characters that I've played, but think about the exact opposite of whatever is written.
Aha!
Yes. And think about how, and I remember doing a sort of workshop with some younger actors and just, you know, seeing, you know, your interpretation of what makes this character tough. And I thought, yes, but what the actors that I admire and the performances that I love are ones where you can always see the opposite of whatever it is that helps to highlight the trait that is sitting on the surface. And so if the character is a villain, what makes him graceful and virtuous? If the character is earnest, what is he hiding? If the character is strong, what are his vulnerabilities? If the character is powerful, what are his weaknesses? It's like, you know, and I think just always being aware of that and trying to be aware of which ones, which of those qualities you bring innately, which of those qualities do you get for free? Which of those do I not need to highlight because they kind of are at the surface on me? And I think that particularly The Punisher gave me an opportunity, especially in the second season, I think they gave me more freedom to just, you know, ignore the stage direction sometimes. And I think if the character was screaming and throwing a chair, I would sit in the corner and cry. If the character was sitting in the corner feeling sorry for himself, I would scream and throw a chair. You know, I just would think, is the opposite of whatever this is available to me?
That is one of the best notes I have heard all day. And you know, I've just gone through six.
That's good. Yes. Great.
You're an incredible talent. And I hope to get to talk to you again more and even more in depth, because there's so much to cover and you've given so much insight. And I really love the example of really leaning into who you are, where you are at that moment, and how heavily it's influenced and magnetized other people to choose you to be responsible for portraying that character, that role. Even what you just shared with us is, that's fucking great. That's what, like, that's what people need to do, is figure out that it's a very simple tactic of making it your own, and also allowing and not making a crazy choice that's outside the box. It's just allowing the audience or the casting directors, the studio, to see something different that they've already seen 100 times, and it might not work, but they can redirect you.
And of course, at the upper echelons of the business, that of course there's people that get cast because they are who they are.
Right.
But I think the rest of the time, the only reason you'll ever get cast in something is because you're you.
Yes.
And you brought, it's the only reason anyone ever gets a job, is because something that you thought about or you felt in that moment or was going on with you.
Yes.
You know, really, really kind of managed to shine through the cloud. And, you know, just that, you know, I usually, before I go into an audition, I still get quite anxious in the room auditions. I will be honest. That still makes me very anxious, but I try to like tell myself before I go in the room, they want you to be it. They're sitting there waiting for the person to come along and be the thing they want. And if you do it your way, you know, hopefully that will be something they respond to. But also 8 times out of 10, it won't be. And that's got to be okay.
And that's part of the grit. To keep going your journey. I thank you for your time and being so vulnerable and open to share this.
I love the conversation.
It's such a lovely conversation for me to have at the end of the day. I've admired your work since, I mean, honestly, once you exploded into Westworld, I went back through because like I've been doing this for so long and you've been on the list for a while to get to have a conversation with. So thank you for being open and honest and sharing this time with
me. No, I love this. Thank you.
Where can everybody find you? First, before I have you go, did you know that alliterated names, your Ben Barnes, BB, have 90% chance of being more successful in life?
Really?
Yes, Mr. Ben Barnes.
God, I'm just cheating all the way along, aren't I?
I mean, your parents, God bless them, thank them for making your name alliterated. And also thank them for making it so easy to pronounce. So every time you walk into a room, people want to say your name. It's easy to say.
I have very, very good old friends who always say both my names still to this day.
It's that thing. You're that guy. It's that. And you are that. And I just wanted to say that before we left. I love it. So where can people find you, Mr. Ben Barnes?
Where can they find me?
Yes, on Instagram. Not in your...
rather conveniently, I'm at Ben Barnes on everything. So that's...
Keeping it simple. I love it. And when does Shadow and Bone come out on Netflix?
I don't know yet. We did manage to finish the filming about a week before the world shut down, which feels unbelievably lucky because it would feel very frustrating, I'm sure, to have a few weeks left and not know when you could complete it. But it is finished and they are still editing and doing everything and you know, it will take a long time because it's got a lot of scope, that show, for sure. But hopefully, at the end of the year or beginning of next year, I really don't know.
And did Lee direct all 8 or did he just do the pilot for you guys, Lee Tolan Krieger?
Just the pilot. But
he's a talent, right?
He's wonderful, yeah.
He's a wonderful man to work with. He's wonderful. I can't wait to see that. Thank you for this time. And I want to have you again soon.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'd love that.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Go check out Westworld, The Punisher, Gold Digger. There's so many wonderful themes. Killing Bono, Jackie and Ryan. Ben Barnes is a scene stealer in most of everything that he is in. Very special thank you to Lizzie Dalla Beta, who wrote this episode, and to everybody that works on this show: Chase Jennings, Zachary Jameson, El Pal, Bibi Katsinas, and all the fabulous writers that get this out every single week and make it possible for you to listen. If you like the show, please rate, review, tell a friend, shout us out on Instagram @AlishaOxy @ThatOneAudition. Till next time.